for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. After months of posting hundreds of thousands of classified documents on the internet, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is sitting in London prison after being denied bail. He faces extradition to Sweden over sexual assault charges, even as the U.S. is looking at whether he can be charged here under the Espionage Act. This could have implications for other news organizations. In the meantime, WikiLeaks supporters have gone on the offensive. Joining us to talk about the latest on this story, here in the studio, Tom Jelton of NPR and Stephen Vladek of American University School of Law. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning,
Jelton.
Diane.
And good morning to you, Stephen.
Good morning, Diane.
Tom Jelton, where do things stand with Julian Assange today?
Well, Julian Assange is in prison and behind bars in London, as you say. He was denied bail, so we presume he will stay there until December 14th, which I think is his scheduled court appearance. The issue now, he's not, of course, been charged in Britain. He's facing allegations in Sweden, and the Swedish authorities want to talk to him about those allegations, want to question him. So now the question is how and whether he would be transferred to Sweden to face those charges or allegations. And secondly, whether in the midst of that decision, whether the United States might intervene with the British authorities and try and get him transferred to the United States to face possible charges here, as you suggest.
And Stephen Vladek, as the U.S. is looking at prosecuting, what could or would they charge him with?
Well, I think, Diane, the candidate we've heard the most about is the Espionage Act, you know, this 93-year-old statute that sweeps very broadly. I mean, I think one of the real questions lurking over this case is just how broadly. The Espionage Act isn't the only possibility. There are some other federal statutes that, for example, deal with conversion of government property, theft of diplomatic communications, and so forth. The problem in Assange's case is that he's not the thief. Right, he's the middleman. He's the person who took the cables that were disclosed by Bradley Manning and then disseminated them to the public. So it's a bit of a stretch for the government. They've never actually brought a case like this before if they decide to bring one against Assange.
Do we have any idea how Bradley Manning got this material, Tom?
What we know, Diane, is that after 9/11, there were a number of changes that took place within the intelligence community that involved sharing intelligence much more broadly in two directions. First, across agencies, across departments, so that intelligence data, cables, reports, et cetera, that were, say, the property of the military or the CIA or the State Department were shared across agencies. Secondly, a lot of those reports were pushed forward down to soldiers, essentially, or low-level people working on the front lines in the belief that the insights from that intelligence would make them a more effective fighting force. So you had intelligence shared much more broadly in two directions to the extent, you know, we've heard that up to 2 million people had access to the material that has been leaked. And given that, it should not be surprising that someone, even a private first class like Bradley Manning, if in fact he is the source of this material, it should not be surprising that he did have access to it.
So is he under arrest right now as well, Stephen?
I mean, he is. I think, you know, my understanding of where his case stands is that there are concerns about his mental state and that I think he's in, you know, the question is whether he's actually, you know, a danger to himself right now, whether he's going to be competent for further proceedings. You know, I think he's in a whole lot of trouble, both psychologically and legally. And so I think that's why it's not necessarily clear where things are going to go with him.
You know, Diane, there's just no question that he does face serious charges. I mean, as Stephen said earlier, if there is a thief here, if there was a crime committed, and I think it's pretty obvious that there was a crime committed, it would definitely be he would be the one that would really face the serious charges.
And yet, it's the U.S. Department of Justice thinking about bringing a case against Julian Assange. If they did, what would the implications of that be, Stephen?
I think the implications would be enormous, and I think that's part of why everyone's paying so much attention. In the 93-year history of the Espionage Act, the government has brought exactly one prosecution of someone other than the immediate thief or spy or leaker, and that was 5 years ago in the AIPAC case, and that prosecution fell apart. The government has never prosecuted someone under the Espionage Act for publishing classified information. And so I think the real question becomes, if the government can prosecute someone like Assange for distributing this information publicly, what separates Assange from the New York Times or from other media organizations
or
anyone else who has publicly redistributed these cables, or a private citizen at home who downloads a cable onto their computer? I mean, the Espionage Act is so broadly worded that it could conceivably apply in any of those cases. And that's why I think the implications are so profound.
How solid is the information regarding Julian Assange and rape, Tom?
That's a hard question for me to answer, Diane, because the law in Sweden is very different from the law in the United States. And activity that might not be prosecutable in the United States apparently is in Sweden. The law is written much more broadly, and women have a lot more leeway in pressing charges for sexual assault in Sweden than they do in the United States. You know, as I understand it, he's been accused in two cases of being involved in sexual activity that started out as consensual but then ended up being non-consensual. And I think that is a pretty serious charge in Sweden. Now, would an
pretty tough line to prove, too.
It's a tough line to prove. And you know, it also raises the question of whether if Julian Assange were anyone else, you know, would the Swedish authorities be going to this much trouble to get their hands on him? I think that's a legitimate question.
Stephen.
I think Tom has it exactly right. And I think the real question is something we cannot know, which is whether there's been pressure brought to bear by the U.S. government, by other governments, on the Swedish authorities to bring this case, to pursue it, to see how far it goes. The Swedish prosecutor said, I think yesterday, that she had not been in contact with any U.S. government officials. But I thought it was curious that she said, I have not been in contact with any government officials. You know, it leaves open the very distinct possibility that there are senior level communications taking place about this case. I think the real point here, though, is the prosecution in Sweden is very politically useful to the Obama administration because it buys them time, right? Assange, as Tom said at the top, is in jail. He's in custody. He's not going anywhere anytime soon, except perhaps to Sweden. And so, you know, if the administration, if the U.S. government wants to pursue charges, the goings-on in Sweden give them a little bit more breathing room and a little bit more time to sort of get their ducks in a row.
Stephen Vladek, he's an American University professor of law who specializes in national security law and constitutional law. And, of course, Tom Jelton is correspondent for NPR. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Let's back up a little bit and talk about how serious the information is that has been released by WikiLeaks, Tom.
You know, Diane, I think the most serious information leak probably were the cables from Afghanistan and Iraq, where sources were actually identified. Sources of intelligence were identified by name. That is a very serious development, one that intelligence professionals worry a lot about and take very seriously. I think this latest dump of diplomatic cables is far more embarrassing. It's embarrassing. It's not really damaging in the same sense that the intelligence reports were damaging. This raises questions about, you know, whether foreign officials and U.S. diplomats will feel free to speak privately and candidly about the issues that they face? Or do they always have to stop and think, you know, is what I say now going to become public, in which case they'll be far more guarded? That could arguably really damage the sort of the process of diplomacy, which is pretty important to peace and stability in the world.
Stephen.
I think that's right. The other thing I would say is, from a legal perspective, I think the critical point is it doesn't matter how many of the documents are harmful to national security as long as some of them are. And so, you know, even if we can look at many of these cables and say, well, I have no idea why this was classified, and I have no idea why this is something that the government wants to keep a secret, as long as there's a handful, really as long as there's one where the average citizen, say the prospective juror, would say, oh, well, wait a second, it's pretty clear how this information, if disclosed, could harm national security, that's the point at which we start getting into the Espionage Act. And I think that's why the government might be on stronger footing than a lot of people might think.
Is Julian Assange a journalist?
You know, I would say no. I mean, to me, maybe I'm really old-fashioned, Diane, but I think of a journalist as someone who actually writes, you know, who actually has thoughts of his or her own. I mean, he has written op-eds, but basically he is a publisher rather than a chronicler, rather than a journalist. And I, you know, as I say, maybe that's an old-fashioned distinction, but it's one that I would draw.
What do you think, Stephen?
Well, as the non-journalist in the room, you know, I think the answer is probably no, but I'm not sure it matters. You know, the at least legally, the U.S. courts, the Supreme Court, have always been careful to avoid drawing a line between journalists and public citizens exactly because of how difficult it is to do so.
Stephen Vladeck, American University professor of law. Short break, and we'll be right back. And we're talking about a story that's been on the front pages all week long, that regarding the material published by WikiLeaks. Its founder, Julian Assange, is in a British prison as we speak. Not a very comfortable place, more than 100 years old. And he has been denied bail. He comes up for bail again on the 16th of December. The judge thus far has been less than sympathetic about granting that bail. Here in the studio, Stephen Vladeck. He's an American University professor of law. And Tom Gelton. He's correspondent for NPR. Joining us now by phone from his home in San Francisco is Declan McCullough of CNET. And CNET, which is part of the CBS Corporation, he is a political correspondent. Good morning to you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning.
Declan, talk about WikiLeaks and its efforts to protect itself from possible censorship.
Sure. What WikiLeaks has done since last Friday, when WikiLeaks.org came under attack, is it's bolstered its electronic defenses in an attempt to become more difficult to censor. One of these things, one of these techniques has been very obvious. It's the creation of mirror sites. And the last I checked, there's over 1,000 of them, I think over 1,300 of them, in fact, and those are appearing at the rate of about one every 10 minutes. Most of them are overseas in Europe. Some of them are in the U.S., and the idea is that if one WikiLeaks site, the main WikiLeaks site, is taken offline by legal or extra-legal efforts, then the other ones will continue to exist. The other mechanism it's used is a little less visible, and that's behind the scenes. Instead of using U.S.-based companies there's one in Reno, Nevada it used for a portion of its infrastructure. It's moved that outside of the United States to Toronto. Instead of using only one company to direct traffic to its primary website, it now uses 14. This is to provide redundancy in the case of attacks, and all that has happened since last Friday or so.
And, of course, you've also had a number of companies distancing themselves from WikiLeaks, and you've got companies like PayPal and Amazon.com and Visa, as well as MasterCard. Now, what does that mean potentially for WikiLeaks?
It doesn't actually mean that much in the short run, because what's happening is U.S.-based companies or companies with substantial U.S. operations are distancing themselves from WikiLeaks. But my reading of the situation is this was actually planned. There are plenty of web hosting providers in Europe that are as good as the ones in the U.S., to a rough approximation, but WikiLeaks chose to use Amazon.com. They chose to use domain name providers that were based in the U.S., and I think that was actually just to make a point that they knew this would be inevitably attacked. This is what Senator Lieberman's staff spent a good portion of last week doing, and then it would make the U.S. look a little silly for applying so much pressure on U.S. companies when, in fact, the information's still available and is at over 1,000 websites. In the long run, though, if the U.S. is able to cut off the flow of funds, that's a more significant threat. If you're in Europe, you can still use bank transfers. If you're in the U.S., you can still send checks via the post to WikiLeaks. But you have the heads of some committees, Peter King, incoming chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, and his counterparts in the Senate saying, let's declare WikiLeaks, please, State Department, declare WikiLeaks to be a terrorist organization on the same list as Al-Qaeda. So then it would be illegal to provide them with material support, and also banks would be prohibited from processing payments.
But now, Stephen Vladek, if you declared WikiLeaks a terrorist organization, what are the implications?
Again, I think the implications would be profound. I mean, the terrorist organization list, which has been around for about 15 or 16 years, is controlled by the State Department, and it has, at least right now, the kinds of groups that we would expect to find on it. You know, Al-Qaeda, terrorist groups in the Middle East, terrorist groups in Southeast Asia. I think you'd see a very pronounced and sustained legal battle over whether the State Department can really put on this list an entity, an organization that is simply an information broker. And I think that's where you'd see some very serious First Amendment arguments made on behalf of WikiLeaks.
Tom Shelton.
Well, it would really require a redefinition of the concept of terrorism, which we have always associated with violence. No one is alleging that WikiLeaks advocates, much less coordinates or directs any kind of campaign of violence. It's what they do is they release, publish information that can be, that arguably is injurious to U.S. interests. But is that terrorism? To call WikiLeaks a terrorist organization would really change our whole idea of what terrorism means.
Declan McCullough, we talked about other organizations like Amazon. What about Twitter and Facebook? Where do they stand on the WikiLeaks case?
Sure. There's a shadowy group named Anonymous. It's a collection of online activists, hackers turned activists for the most part, who have been coordinating attacks for the last few years against companies or entities they just don't like very much. And what's happened in the last few days is that Anonymous has taken up the cause of WikiLeaks and has taken efforts to try to knock offline the websites for MasterCard. It was yesterday morning, MasterCard, yesterday afternoon, it was Visa. And this is done via what's called a distributed denial of service attack. It's kind of, imagine Eddie Bauer or Land's End or a company with an 800 number that has 20 incoming phone lines. Well, if 20 people keep calling and hanging up and calling and hanging up, you can probably deny the use of this 800 number to the rest of the world. And so that's what Anonymous is trying to do here. They're coordinating via Twitter. They had over 22,000 followers on Twitter yesterday. Twitter yanked the account. They're back with another account. There was a Facebook page that Facebook deleted. And so it's interesting that Facebook wouldn't delete WikiLeaks or a WikiLeaks fan page, but they did delete the Anonymous sort of coordination page. And so this is kind of an information-based war. That might be overstating the case. It's information-based activism trying to knock these websites offline, at least temporarily, which is, by the way, illegal. And I should point out that Visa said to us yesterday is that it didn't affect the actual payment processing. It was just the front end, the website visa.com.
That's where the question of terrorism could come in, Stephen.
Well, again, I think it's dangerous to throw the word terrorism around lightly in this day and age. I mean, I think Declan's exactly right that there comes a point where these kinds of coordinated attacks on companies do cross legal limits and do cross the line. You know, I'd be very reluctant to use the word terrorism. They're crimes, and it's important that we realize that they're crimes, but not all crimes are terrorism.
You know, there's an interesting new development here, Diane, which is that a distributed denial of service attack that Declan was talking about requires a large number of computers to be used, you know, in this attack. Now, what we've seen in the past are that criminal groups or hacking groups basically hijack people's computers without their knowledge and use them for an attack. What is new in this case is that Anonymous has made it possible for people who want to support WikiLeaks to basically lend their computers voluntarily to this effort. You're able to, you don't even have to be a hacker. You can just download some very simple software, click OK, and Anonymous will take care of the rest. They will use your computer in this attack. So it is a voluntary effort, and that is something that we have not seen before. It really gives, you know, we think of anti-globalization activists who throw rocks through McDonald's and so forth. This is a new form of protest that we have not seen before that is very effective and potentially quite destructive.
Stephen.
Well, and I think, you know, it's important to remember that the real question here is, can you actually put the cork back in the bottle? You know, once all this information is out in the public domain, can governments, can private companies, can whoever is trying to do so actually take the information offline? And I think we're now learning a lesson that I think China has learned quite powerfully over the last 10 years, which is that once information is on the internet and once it's in the public domain, the cat's out of the bag. And so the question is, you know, shouldn't the remedies be only forward-looking and not trying to actually undo what's already been done?
How would a U.S. Supreme Court look at a case like this, Stephen?
Well, the current Supreme Court is no friend of activism like this. And so I think, you know, there's the question of whether, as an ideal matter, you know, you'd see this kind of speech protection be the issue in the Supreme Court. My view is that even this Supreme Court, which has been no friend of this kind of activism, which has not really been a particular fan of the First Amendment, for example, last year in the terrorism material support case, I think would find that there's a line. And that the line is either very close to where Julian Assange is or just past it. I mean, there has to be a point beyond which the First Amendment protects the right of everyday people to retransmit information that's already in the public domain. And if the First Amendment doesn't protect that, then I'm not really sure what we're doing here.
Declan McCullough, do you want to add to that?
It's interesting to see the Obama administration seemed to make the argument, I may be reading too much into this, but I don't think so, that WikiLeaks is not a journalist, or Julian Assange is not a journalist, and so they're trying to already build this foundation in public for saying if they do pursue criminal charges and seek extradition from, I presume, Sweden or the UK, that the First Amendment doesn't, as we know it today, doesn't apply. You heard the State Department spokesman say yesterday that he defends the role of journalists in your daily pursuits. That's a quote, but Mr. Assange is not a journalist, and the Pentagon has also made that distinction, saying that this is soliciting U.S. government officials to break the law, and that's something that journalists don't do. So I think we're seeing part of that legal case already being built in public statements.
Except that, I mean, I think that's right. The interesting thing about Declan's point is that these arguments sound lovely to our ears, but this is the exact issue that arose 5 years ago when the New York Times and the Washington Post broke the NSA warrantless wiretapping program. And there you heard the exact opposite, which is, well, you're publishing and you're disseminating, and so therefore you're breaking the law.
Stephen Vladeck, he's an American University professor of law, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Tom Gelton, how likely is the UK to allow the extradition of Julian Assange?
I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that extradition is an issue that governments around the world take very tough positions on. It is not by any means, even for such a close U.S. ally as Britain, it's not something that is by any means automatic. Now, Assange has not yet been charged. He's not been indicted in the United States. So it's really premature to talk about extradition in any formal sense. And even if he were, the British authorities would have to be convinced that the charges against him are serious enough that considering that he is not either a U.S. citizen or even in the territory of the United States, that it was a reasonable request from the United States.
And joining us now from his home in London, John Burns. He's chief foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Good morning to you, John. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
How likely do you believe that the UK is to agree to extradite Julian Assange to the United States?
I think it's not clear that that will happen. As you know, that there was a bail hearing on Tuesday at the Westminster Magistrates Court in the center of London, ironically, almost in the shadow of the headquarters of MI5 and MI6 and of the British Parliament. And the district judge who took that hearing, Howard Riddle, spent a great deal of the time asking pretty tough questions of the lawyer representing the Swedish government in this affair, skeptical questions about the nature of the evidence in the case, in the Swedish case involving sexual improprieties. The odd and ironic thing was that the hearing turned on a technical issue, that is to say the denial of bail, came toward the end, of course, when Mr. Assange, defiant, refused to give a street address in the United Kingdom, which would have been a condition of getting a bail. He had plenty of people who had turned up, Jemima Khan, the celebrity and activist, Ken Loach, the filmmaker, five or six other people who were prepared to pledge cash surety for him. But that refusal on Assange's part to give his street address, he actually offered a P.O. box address in Australia and then a street address in Australia, having previously refused to give the police, as those under arrest in this country are required to do, a DNA swab, fingerprints, or have his photograph taken. That persuaded the district judge, Howard Riddle, that he was a flight risk. Up to that point, my impression was, and this goes to your question about the likelihood of his being extradited, that at the first point of encounter with the British judicial system, Mr. Assange's lawyers were making at least a prima facie case against the Swedish extradition order that was likely to result in protracted hearings here and possibly to provide the grounds, even if an extradition order is issued, endorsed by the Home Secretary of the United Kingdom, provide the grounds for an appeal to the European Court on Human Rights in Strasbourg in France. And we know from past experiences, mainly involving terrorist cases, that when that happens, the hearing can be extended, the process can be extended for months or even years.
So I just want to make clear, that was extradition to Sweden and not extradition to the United States. Is that correct?
That's correct. And there's implications here for what the Obama administration now chooses to do, having said that it is reviewing the possibility of criminal sanctions against Mr. Assange.
John Burns, he's chief foreign correspondent for The New York Times. He joins us from Cambridge, England. We'll take a short break. When we come back, it's time to open the phones for your questions, comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Overbrook Foundation, supporting CatalogChoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail. This is NPR.
A provocative new novel explores the limits of the mother-child bond. It's titled Room. And the author talks about finding love and resilience in a harrowing situation. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back as we talk about the case of WikiLeaks. And right now, Julian Assange sits in a British prison without bail. He'll come up for that bail hearing again on the 16th of December. But if, as you've just heard from John Burns, the chief foreign correspondent for the New York Times, when he came before the judge, his lawyer refused to give an address in Britain and was, in part because of that, denied bail. Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you today?
Fine, thanks. Go right ahead, sir.
I'm calling about to get your guests' points or maybe their opinions on broader concerns for our government's response in regard to civil liberties. Right now, the U.S. hasn't charged this man with any crimes, and it's from what they say, it doesn't sound like that's likely to happen. But despite that, a number of private businesses have been pressured to stop doing business with the man. We've got legislators and high government officials talking about this man's treason, or he's not treason. He's not
right.
an American citizen.
Right.
But I mean, you're talking about things that he's done to damage the U.S. I mean, there's no question that the exposure to the way we conduct business overseas is damaging to the U.S. But I mean, you could say the same thing about the extensive coverage of the legislative process last year during the health care debate. Obviously, that didn't help our government any.
All right. Thanks for your call. Stephen Vladek, the question of who is making decisions here in this country as to the outcome of what happens to Julian Assange?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the responsibility rests almost entirely with Attorney General Eric Holder. Both by tradition and by statute, he is the chief law enforcement officer. He would be the official who decides that we want to pursue an indictment in a particular district court. I suspect if it happened, it would be, you know, a district court perhaps here in the Washington area. And then it would be from there that there would be a formal request for extradition to whichever country Assange is then found in. If it were anytime soon, it would be Britain. And I think, you know, that's when the things would get interesting, as they say.
John Burtons, how long can the Brits hold Julian Assange without bail?
Well, I think they can hold him as long as the district court judge feels that's necessary. We'll have to see. I think because of the highly political nature of this case, there may be some pressures, some felt pressures, to get him out of Wandsworth Prison, which is altogether a rather unpleasant place to be. As you've mentioned, it's a prison that it's a 19th century prison. It holds 1,600 prisoners, many of them convicted of serious criminal offenses. It's not the kind of place that you or I would want to spend even a few hours, much less a week or longer. So I think that when the bail hearing is held again next Tuesday, there's at least a reasonable chance that Assange will be bailed, assuming that he then agrees to meet the conditions that he was not prepared to meet on this past Tuesday. I think the question does arise whether Mr. Assange really wants to be out on bail. He told me when I met him a few weeks ago that sometimes the thought of being in prison seemed rather attractive as a way of getting away from all the pressures that he has been under, and as he said, to have a chance to read a book. And there's also, of course, the martyrdom factor. There's no doubt that Julian Assange sitting in a prison is adding to his iconic status amongst those people who regard him as being the, if you will, the standard bearer for a millennial mission.
John Burns, what's your impression of Julian Assange?
Well, there's no doubt that Julian Assange is extraordinarily clever, extraordinarily bright, and that he has sort of caught a historic moment. This was going to happen sooner or later with the storage of vast amounts of data on computers, inadequately protected, as we could see in this case. Sooner or later, somebody was going to found a WikiLeaks, and sooner or later, somebody was going to do something like Mr. Assange has done. But it has to be said, and this one can say on the authority of many of those who have worked closely with him in WikiLeaks, that he's a complex character as well. He's autocratic, he's capricious, he tolerates no dissent. He is profoundly of the conviction that the United States is a force for evil in the world, that it's destructive of democracy. He wants to lead the world, as he proclaims it, to a brave new world of openness and transparency and honesty, and there'll be no information borders. In fact, there'll be no secrecy at all. In all of this, my sense of him was that he fits a profile that we've seen many times before, and people who move history by a minute or a degree or two one way or the other, they're not ordinary people. He is certainly not an ordinary person, but he may also be his own worst enemy because he is extremely defiant. He is relishing this battle with the United States. And when you go to war with the United States, even if it's only an information war, you're going to have to watch excuse the vernacular, you're going to have to watch your backside.
John, are you convinced that he is totally in control of his faculties?
Oh, yes. I don't think there's much question about that. I think there's a debate probably to be had about whether people of this extraordinary intelligence and extraordinary degree of self-belief are quite normal, like you and I are, but I wouldn't suggest for a minute that Julian Assange is crazed. He's certainly not crazed. Everything he has done has shown an extraordinary intellectual grasp and perception and technical ability. This is a formidable ally, formidable opponent for the United States, as your the others on this panel have pointed out. They have WikiLeaks, which doesn't have a lot of people. It has a core group of about 40 people and a few hundred volunteers around the world, has so far managed to stay ahead of the most powerful nation on Earth.
Tom Gilton.
No, I just wanted to point out that this does, in fact, as John is now suggesting, go beyond Julian Assange. I mean, WikiLeaks as an organization is continuing, and theoretically, at least, it could survive even his imprisonment. And this raises the question of, okay, so Assange is in prison. What do you do about WikiLeaks as an operation? And we have had voices in this country, notably including former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, saying that the United States should take action to close WikiLeaks down. Now, that is a very different type of operation, a different thought than going after one individual on criminal grounds. This really would require some cyber operation to go after that organization, and that raises a whole bunch of other issues that we haven't even talked about.
Stephen Vladek.
And it may backfire. I mean, the irony of all of this is that the more aggressively the United States moves to shut down this operation, the more pushback we're going to see. And, you know, and I think this goes back to the basic point that whether or not Julian Assange is a criminal and whether or not he belongs in jail, you know, you really can't stop information from proliferating, from spreading.
Let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina. Good morning, Joel.
Yeah, good morning. My question is, does this not smack of hypocrisy? When we, in our democracy, we pride ourselves as being the most democratic nation in the whole world, there's freedom of speech, freedom of dissemination of information. Then all of a sudden, somebody brings up something that's supposed to be the truth that we've done. Then all of a sudden, he decides to be tough, and he needs to be prosecuted.
All right. Declan McCullough, do you want to comment?
It's a fair point. We have the Secretary of State giving a high-profile speech at the end of January. If I recall properly, it was down at the museum, saying the internet is something that we need to embrace and we need to protect press freedom online. And Senator Joseph Lieberman, probably WikiLeaks' most strident critic, who has also suggested that even the New York Times could be prosecuted. He's one of the founders of the Global Freedom Caucus in the Senate. I think we are a little vulnerable to charges of hypocrisy there. I mean, if we really believe in free speech, then do we also believe in disclosing classified information online? It's a difficult question for the U.S. to answer because they didn't. Secretary Clinton didn't put a footnote on it in her speech saying, "Well, except for WikiLeaks back in January."
Stephen.
Well, I think we say lots of nice things about how much we believe in free speech and how important we think free speech is to developing countries around the world. The reality is that it's technology that requires us to keep secrets. I mean, if you ask the government what are the most essential secrets we keep, you know, building nuclear weapons, right? You know, creating nuclear reactors, things that could be used for great destructive power against Americans, against anyone around the world. And so I think the real question is, if we accept that there must be some secrets, how do we draw the line? You know, and I think there's a larger, longer conversation to have about how much we overclassify information in this day and age. You know, I resist the notion that there's nothing in our current world that should be kept secret. I think the government has at least some credibility in saying that there's at least a category of information that it can keep from the public.
Tom Gilton.
Just one line from Hillary Clinton's speech in January. Information networks are helping people discover new facts and making governments more accountable. You have to wonder if she'd like to have those words back.
Yeah. Right, let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Linda.
Yes, good morning. The emperor has no clothes. The U.S. emperor, the war on freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and freedom of expression is just mind-boggling. The real crime is U.S. foreign policy of belligerence and duplicity and deception. And for them to be putting this coercion on the publisher of these things is just, I think, it's just wrong.
John Burns, how do you see it?
Well, I think that all new technologies throughout history have opened new vistas and new horizons, and eventually You know, we learn of ways to manage and in some respects restrain these technologies. I'd give you the example of the motor car. The worst number of fatal road accidents in Britain occurred in the 1920s and 30s when it was virtually unregulated. We're going to have to find ways, as some of your contributors have said, to make sure that the state, in this case the United States, is able to protect secrets that it needs to protect in the face of this new technology. And I've no doubt that in time that will happen. And we're at an early stage of the debate. And we don't really know where along the spectrum of all of this we're going to end up. And there's a good debate to be had about it.
John Burns, he's chief correspondent for the New York Times. He joins us from Cambridge, England. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To Elon, North Carolina, good morning, Dale.
Good morning. I'd like to take strong issue with the idea that Julian Assange is not a journalist. I expect that publishers across this country were cringing at that notion. You know, back from the beginnings of our country, publisher journalists like Ben Franklin, there was no distinction between a publisher and journalist. And further, as your panel knows, in 2001, the U.S. Supreme Court said the middleman, a journalist, couldn't be prosecuted under privacy law. So there's strong precedent here. And one more notion, we own this information. We in America own our information. The government holds it on our behalf, and they can only withhold it under specific exemptions. And for these reasons, I just find it abhorrent that Assange would be prosecuted in the United States under the Espionage Act.
Stephen Vladek.
Well, I mean, I agree with Dale that we have a tradition in this country of citizen journalism. And I think that's exactly why, as I said before, we've been very reluctant to draw bright lines legally between journalists and private citizens. The 2001 case Dale's referring to is a case called Bartnicki versus Vopper. And I think it's actually, unfortunately, instructive in the other direction. The Supreme Court there said you couldn't go after the middleman. It was a radio station for playing an illegally intercepted phone conversation over the air. But the court's decision rested on the fact that the radio station legally had the tape. So even though it was illegally recorded, the radio station came into it through legal means. The problem with the Espionage Act is that it is illegal for anyone who is not entitled to possess it to retain classified information. And so Bartnicki really wouldn't help a journalist in this case.
John Burns, we've been talking thus far about how this could play out in the United States. How is it playing out in London and Europe?
Well, the debate is pretty well parallels that in the United States, of course. In Britain and in most European countries, there is nothing quite so broad as the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. So there's some degree of novelty to this, but European newspapers, European broadcast outfits have been absolutely as fascinated with all the material that WikiLeaks has produced on the two wars and now the State Department cables, as have American publications. Indeed, as you know, that WikiLeaks has so-called media partners who have been given prior access to these documents before WikiLeaks posted them, the New York Times amongst them. But the other partners are Der Spiegel in Germany and The Guardian, as well as some other European organizations. So these issues are being vigorously debated. I think that there is a fairly strong popular support for the idea that there's a public interest has been served by these disclosures, but there's also a fairly common feeling that there has to be some limit to this, and there's a limit that's recognized by the media partners, by the New York Times. I recommend to your readers that they look at the editor's notes on the New York Times website posted by Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times, who has talked about just exactly how stringent the New York Times has been in deciding which of these cables to post and which not to, how careful we have been to see that we only deal with redacted material, and how we acknowledge that there is within this tranche of material, as there would inevitably be with an undifferentiated disclosure of this kind, material that the New York Times, at least, would choose not to publish.
And, John, considering, as you say, divided opinion all over the world, what is your best guess as to how the London court is going to deal with Julian Assange?
My guess is that he will get bail. I don't think that he is going to be so defiant and so stubborn as to refuse to give a street address. I think the bail will be posted pretty stiffly by Howard Riddle, the district court judge, and we will then see a very protracted legal process. And we'll have to wait and see whether the United States lays charges, which would then result in another extradition hearing, either here in London, if Assange is still here, or in Stockholm, had he been extradited there.
All right. And we'll have to leave it there. John Burns, chief foreign correspondent for The New York Times. Declan McCullough, chief political correspondent for CNET, part of the CBS Corporation. Stephen Vladek, American University professor of law. Tom Gelton, correspondent for NPR. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.